to understand the commitment to embodiment in those models. And using that as the springboard, I'll then try and forge some links with understandings and understanding of embodiment that comes out of Christine Battersby's work. And in the end, I want to end up just with problems, right? And this is a talk, the tagline for this talk is don't get your hopes up, right? Because there are no solutions in this talk, there are only problems, right? So let's see how we get on. All right, so this paradigm of embodied cognition, there are various ways in which embodiment might, you might think, in recent cognitive science has become important. I'm not going to cover all of them. Sometimes it's got to do with the specification of concepts. Sometimes it's got to do with the specification of experience. But one way in which embodied cognition gets played out is through the idea that when we think about intelligence, the old kind of brain-centric model, neurocentric model, you might think, that was very much dominant in cognitive science as well as everywhere else for such a long time, has to be pushed aside. And a very simple, straightforward, intuitive example of that, which is not rocket science in any sense, is thinking about how you solve a jigsaw puzzle. Right? So solving a jigsaw puzzle, most people don't try and solve the problem in their head and then just move the pieces around. Right? What they do is they pick up the pieces, they try them out, they push them into place, they re-evaluate when things don't fit. And a simple thought here is that the bodily movements of the cognizer are actually part of the intelligence here. And you can't really understand the way real people solve jigsaw puzzles unless you get that right. And of course, once you get that right, it changes our understanding of what the neural circuitry is doing. We don't no longer need neural circuitry that does sort of advanced planning of shape rotation. Rather, we need neural circuitry that can move hands around and spot patterns in the right kind of way. So that's a very simple example, but one I think that just gives you a kind of a feel for how this might work. Now, a way you might put this in more general philosophical terms, you might say according to the embodied cognition view, bodily acts and bodily structures sometimes figure as central aspects of an agent's problem-solving strategies. At least, as I say, it's one theme in the notion of embodied cognition. Because embodied strategies will often encompass rich environmental interaction, the embodied mind is also typically an embedded mind. It's a mind that is interlocked in various ways with its environment. And the way that real embodied intelligent creatures get things done is at least in part through this interlocking with environmental structure, through embodied activity. So you might say that there's a view here, we might call it the embodied embedded view, such that bodily and environmental factors account for some of the richness and flexibility of intelligent behaviour. And that's just one way of understanding the view. Now, Christine did a lot of work for me earlier, fortunately, so I can be quite brief. The notion of situatedness here that Christine mentioned, I have to say that in the way that notion is used within situated robotics, within the empirical science here, by people like Rob Brooks, I don't think it actually means any more than a design strategy according to which the robot regularly senses its environment in order to guide its actions. So a bit like solving the jigsaw puzzle by trying out moving pieces around rather than trying to, as it were, plan out the solution in the head. Now, there's a bigger issue there. I mean, that's something to be thought about. But I'm just going to use the term situated in that sense for today. So situated robots, as people like Rob Brooks and Barbara Webb and others developed them in the 90s, were complete robots capable of integrating perception and action in real time so as to generate fast and fluid adaptive behaviour. And that was the goal of situated robotics. So rather than concentrate on fancy feats of intellectual reflection that will be done in some abstract space, the idea was to build real robots and get them to do real actions in real environments. And one of the things that happened in this process was that roboticists started to think that to get intelligent activity done in real time, what you needed was what we thought of as integrated suites of adaptive couplings that combine neural mechanisms, or their robotic equivalent, non-neural bodily factors and environmental elements as kind of equal partners in the behaviour generating strategy. So the solution to the problem solving activity would be something that would depend essentially on contributions from brain, body and environment. Now as soon as you've said that, of course, robotics becomes a rich storehouse of examples of embodied cognition of the kind that we've been thinking about. So here's two examples of embodied cognition done this way through situated robotics. Now, in a paper from some time ago, Andy Clark and Chris Thornton, a paper called Trading Spaces, constructed an argument which was supposed to convince us that some bits of cognition needed a little inner stage, a little brain-based stage, where raw input data from the environment had to somehow be re-represented. And the idea here was there are certain statistics that intelligent creatures are sensitive to, certain statistical patterns, that you just can't get from the first order statistics that you get from the environment. You've got to re-represent those statistics internally in order to pull out higher order patterns and so on. Now, quite interestingly, a little bit of embodied cognition work with robots showed that that isn't actually necessarily the case. It's not necessary to solve these kinds of problems, which often involve relations between things in the environment, that you build little internal re-representations of input data. As long as you allow your robot to have a body and to move around, some of these problems get solved, in some sense, for free through embodied movement. So one problem that was in the original Trading Spaces paper was what looks like a very simple problem, the problem of avoiding small cylinders while staying close to large ones. Turns out to be rather a difficult problem because of the statistics of the problem space. But, so the thought was that these involve regularities that are statistically visible only following a systematic recoding of the raw input data. So Clark and Thornton suggest that the brain re-represents the input data, transforming the learning problem into one that the robot can solve. But in fact, Shear and Pfeiffer showed in one of their papers, as I say, if you allow the robot to move around, what the robot does is use its own bodily movements to actively structure the input. Basically, what the robot does is a little circling behaviour, which induces cyclical regularities into the raw input data, and then solves the problem. There is no re-representational stage needed. So embodied cognition solves a problem in a very straightforward and effective way. One that looked like required a lot of computational inner power, but in fact just requires quite simple inner power and the ability to move around with the body. And as Shear and Pfeiffer conclude, by exploiting its body and through the interaction with the environment, the robot can actually generate correlated data that has the property that it can be easily learned. So there's a very simple example of what I'm calling here gross embodiment. So another way you might think about the way the body has got into cognitive science recently is by rethinking the way brains work. Right? Now, most of you in the room are probably committed to a notion of brains, which involve little simple processing units called neurons that talk to each other down connections called synapses. And that is a pretty powerful model of brains. But in fact, that's only one kind of activity that goes on in brains. As Alan Turing pointed out, the great god of computing, many years ago. In the nervous system, chemical phenomena are at least as important as electrical. And apologies to people who've seen me use this example before more than once. Right, so, because you're going to see the same slide. So, recently it's been discovered that there are what are called neurotransmitters in the brain. So neurotransmitters are just the things that affect neuronal activity. Little chemicals sent perhaps down. Signals sent down synapses would be one kind of neurotransmission. But there are neurotransmitters that are so small that they can diffuse in clouds through the brain, thus allowing an individual neuron to affect other neurons to which it's not synaptically connected. Moreover, can affect other neurons in a volume space rather than just a two-dimensional space. What's also crucial about these non-classical neurotransmitters is that they're neural modulators. What that means is they don't just increase the activity or decrease the activity of neurons with which they come into contact. They change the whole processing profile of the way that neuron responds to input. So they change the functional structure of what the brain is doing. So with the same set of neurons and the same set of synaptic connections, you can have multiple functionality because their functions are changed by these diffusing neural modulators. And this is called by some people volume signaling. Now here's, you're not going to see much. Here, here's a kind of picture. There's some neurons connected up by synapses, but there's also a neuron in the middle, neuron 3, that emits a gas and can thus affect all those other neurons in a very short space of time. And here's a little example. We'll get to work. You're not going to see much here. What we've got is a little robot that is trying to go towards a triangle, but not a square. And you're not actually seeing what the robot sees here, because the robot's only got 4 pixels. It can only see little patches of light in 4 places. But how this robot, look at this, and this is the size of the robot's neural network for performing this task. It's really very small indeed. That's all the neurons it's got in its head, and that's its visual senses. But how the robot works is that by its own bodily motion, it just swings around the environment. And as soon as that pattern, a certain pattern of activity is stimulated on the retina by the triangle, and of course the triangle's got a sloping edge and the square hasn't, a gas fires out from one of the neurons and changes the functionality of the network so that the robot goes towards the triangle. It's really a very simple but a very powerful system. So what we've got are embodied structures that are tightly linked to structures in the environment, and we've got a network that can functionally reconsider itself, rewire itself with like gas. That's the idea. Better living through chemistry. So just to show that again, now you know what's going on, you might be able to see better what's happening here. Here's the robot swinging round. Once its visual system connects onto the triangle, there's a burst of gas over here, which actually reconfigures the network, and then the robot starts to go straight towards the triangle, which is as easy as that. Note that this won't work in an environment where there are lots of sloping edges that aren't triangles. It's completely and absolutely over-adapted to its local environment. But that's fine, because that's the environment it lives in. Right? So a lot of embodied cognition strategies depend on that kind of coupling. Okay, so that's interesting, right? That's chemical embodiment. Chemical embodiment rather than, if you like, the standard model of brains as information processors through electrical transmission. So what? Well, a few years ago, in some weird parallelism that happens, I suppose, when you work in the same area a lot, Andy Clark and I both started to think of different kinds of embodiment that might be going on in cognitive science. So I pursued it in a couple of papers that I mentioned there, but I think Andy put it more crisply than I did, so I'm going to steal Andy's quotation from a paper he's called Pressing the Flesh. Andy points out there are two different ways of understanding the notion of embodiment running around in cognitive science. As he puts it, one way of understanding the importance of embodiment depicts the body as intrinsically special and the details of a creature's embodiment as a major and abiding constraint on the nature of its mind. A kind of new wave body centrism. The other depicts the body as just one element in a kind of equal partners dance between brain, body and world, with the nature of the mind fixed by the overall balance thus achieved. A kind of, here we go, extended functionalism, now with an even broader canvas for multiple realisability than ever before. So let's play out these two notions. Now this will be my way of playing out these notions in the way that I did in these papers, so it may depart from Andy's favourite way of doing it, but it doesn't matter for the purposes. So I coined this phrase vital materiality. And we might say the materiality of the body may be said to be vital when bodily acts or bodily structures, whatever they may be, make a special, non-substitutable contribution to cognition. Right? It's non-substitutable. Vital materiality is in tension with something that is very popular in analytic philosophy of mind, the multiple realisability of the mental. The best argument for multiple realisability is Doctor Who. Right? We all watch Doctor Who, we have no problem believing that, you know, creatures can be intelligent, have experiences, whether they're made of gas or metal or, as it was in recent episodes, some sludgy flesh stuff that doppelgangers came out of. Right? That's a kind of folk commitment, but it says something deep about our intuitions about the mind. That we don't actually think that mind is something that has that kind of intrinsic link with the actual physical structure that's underneath it. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. But now go back to Scheer and Pfeiffer's robots, the ones that solve Andy's re-representational problem without representing anything. You could think about Scheer and Pfeiffer's robots as providing a radical alternative to information processing as a way of solving the cylinder problem. Right? You could think that the thing about the solution that Clark and Thornton recommend is it involves computational information processing. And that, you know, we have a view of computation, a software that can run on lots of different hardware, this kind of view, as a kind of disembodied kind of way of thinking about things in a sense. But you might think that the bodily movements of Scheer and Pfeiffer's robots show that they're solving the problem in a non-informational way. Right? It's a radically different solution. You might think that's a kind of claim about vital materiality. If you didn't have a body just like that, you couldn't solve the problem that way. Or think of gas nets, the stuff I showed just now, as examples of what Collins nicely calls embrained knowledge, as Collins puts it. Knowledge is embrained just when cognitive abilities have to do with the physical setup of the brain, where the term physical setup signals not merely the way neurons are interconnected, but also factors to do with the brain as a piece of chemistry or a collection of solid shapes. So again, you could think that's vital materiality, right? It's because of the detailed chemical structure of the brain that there's a solution that looks just like that. All right, now think about a different kind of materiality. Let's call it implementational materiality. To draw a little bit on Andy's formulation, to the extent that the body is conceptualised as no more than a bridge to new functional organisations, its materiality, I want to say, is implementational. Implementational materiality goes hand in hand with multiple realizability, right? So you think that you can specify what it is for something to have a certain mental state or mental process, and that is implemented in the material structure of the agent. And the thought, what you get there is, if you're just thinking about the contribution of the materiality as a kind of implementation of the mind, it's the kind of physical machine on which the mind runs, then you licenses the thought that you could run, as it were, that mind, to use a software analogy, on other kinds of matter or other kinds of material system. So implementational materiality goes hand in hand with multiple realizability. And of course, as many of you know, philosophy of mind 101, functionalism in the philosophy of mind provides a well-established platform for securing multiple realizability and thus implementational materiality. So for those of you who skip that class, right, functionalism is just the view that what makes something a mental state of a particular kind is determined by the way that state contributes causally to producing behaviour between inputs and outputs and other states so defined. The idea is it's the function that matters, not what it's made of. That's the raw intuition. Okay, so there's two kinds of materiality, right? Now think about the restructuring of the learning problem achieved by the bodily movements of Scheer and Pfeiffer's robot as functionally equivalent to the transformation of that problem effected by Clark and Thornton's inner re-representation strategy. So now what we've got is a strategy, right, for reforming the statistics of the input data. You can do it by re-representing internally, or you can do it by moving around, right, and creating different input. But you're still, as it were, restructuring the input. So you can think about Scheer and Pfeiffer's robot as just another implementation of a kind of cognitive strategy of restructuring the input data. One is done by moving around and having a body and restructuring your sensory input in a certain, restructuring your sensory input. The other, the Clark and Thorne strategy, is done by re-representing the data internally. But it's two implementations of the same strategy. Or you could think about diffusing chemicals in the gas nets as micro-functionist vehicles, but nevertheless functionally specified vehicles, for certain kinds of higher level functional reorganisation that could in principle be achieved otherwise. So as it were, the activity that changes the behaviour of the robot from a circling strategy to a going in a straight line strategy, that's achieved here by these kind of low level diffusing clouds of chemicals. But it could be achieved by another kind of information processing strategy. So here we could see these implementation details of a way of specifying mind that doesn't make essential reference to those physical structures that in effect are doing the work here, the causal, in that level of causality. All right, so I hope it's kind of clear that the two examples of embodied cognition don't answer the question of how to think about embodiment. Right? Indeed, they can be interpreted either way. So we don't yet have, despite, you know, this is fantastic work that's going on in the embodied cognition paradigm in the empirical work, it seems there's a problem still to be solved. We don't really know what the embodiment is that we're supposed to get excited about in the notion of embodied cognition. And I think that is exactly the way the field stands right now. There's an intuition about the importance of the body, but we don't yet have a really proper understanding of the notion of embodiment. Now, just as a kind of a sort of diversion, but it's an important one, let's just consider the extended mind hypothesis, right? So the extended mind hypothesis, here's a formulation of it. There are actual, in this world, cases of intelligent action in which thinking and thoughts, more precisely the material vehicles that realise thinking and thoughts, and that's going to give something away here, right? Are spatially distributed over brain, body and world in such a way that the external factors, the beyond the skin factors, are rightly accorded cognitive status. So the general picture, I'm not going to go into the arguments for this, but the general picture is the thought that there are certain kind of contributions to cognitive activity that might be made by notebooks in which information is stored, or bits of mobile software that do bits of reasoning, or indeed just by structures of things like jigsaws perhaps even, where the contribution of those external factors is such that there isn't really any way of thinking that they don't play exactly the same kind of role as certain inner factors either do or could. And so the thought is that if you didn't, you've got to see the cognitive system here, the genuinely cognitive system, as one that, in which those external factors have as big a role to play, and the same kind of role to play in many ways, as the brain. And that's how you, I mean, I can go into details about how to make this hypothesis clearer, but I want to get onto the more interesting questions about embodiment, at least I'll take some more interesting ones today. So, but you get the kind of general thought here, is that we used to think about cognition as something that is brain-bound, and indeed that's the way most people still think about it in cognitive science. But there's a clique, an enthusiastic clique, who think that some of whom are in this room, who think that actually that's the wrong if you're going to locate mind, then you need to locate mind or locate cognitive processes in systems that are distributed through brain, body, and world. Now, think about conventional functionalism, as many of you will know, provides a kind of well-established platform for securing in-the-head multiple realisability. So you say, look, it doesn't matter whether what's in your head is neurons or silicon chips, right? You know, as long as the chips and the neurons play the same kind of functional role, then both the robot and you can share the same mental state. But of course, there's nothing in functionalism that requires you to see it as an in-the-head claim, right? Here's Levy's definition of functionalism from the Stanford Encyclopedia. What makes something a mental state of a particular type doesn't depend on its internal constitution, but rather on the way it functions or the role it plays in the system of which it is a part. So the general formulation of functionalism doesn't mention that the boundaries of the system have to be the edge of the nervous system or the edge of the skin. You've just got to fix your system. Right? So this, functionalism, pure functionalism, without the kind of internalist prejudice that was brought to the table originally, because that was the zeitgeist in thinking about the mind at the time, functionalism understood purely certainly supports the idea that the borders of the cognitive system may fall beyond the sensory motor interface of the organic body. And what I think this shows us is that the extended mind hypothesis, in a modal form, right, it's possible for minds to be extended, it's just straightforwardly entailed by broadly formulated functionalism. So the really exciting hypothesis is functionalism. The extended mind is just a consequence of it. Right? Of course, we don't know that minds are actually extended. That requires doing a lot of empirical and philosophical work, looking at the contribution of environmental factors as parts of integrated systems with brains and bodily movements. But we do, you know, we have a philosophical position that licenses the possibility of extended minds. Of course, there's something we still need, which I'm not going to go into today. That's an account of what functional differences... Well, actually, we'll go into this very briefly. Which functional differences matter when deciding what counts as cognitive? Now, I'm just going to skip this slide and do this more briefly than I would like to, just to save some time. Here's a thought, right? Bill Bechtel, philosopher, sometimes psychologist as well, he argues that cognitive achievements like mathematical reasoning, natural language processing, and natural deduction are the result of sensory motor mediated interactions between internal neural networks and suites of external symbols. Right? Now, what's important about this is the following. Lots of philosophers in the analytic tradition around cognitive science got very excited at one point, some still are, about the phenomenon of systematicity. And this is the thought that you just don't find creatures who can think the thought John loves Mary, but who can't think the thought Mary loves John. Right? That tells us something interesting. Thought is by and large systematic. The explanation for that some people want to suggest is that our inner thinking mechanisms are organised like a language. Why would you think that? Well, because what explains the fact that a creature that can think John loves Mary can also think Mary loves John is that you've got a little symbol in your head for John, one for Mary and one for loves, and you put them together in different ways according to the rules of grammar, in effect. Although the rules of a mental grammar in this case, for complications I won't go into. Now, let's just say systematicity is a genuine phenomenon of thinking. What Bechtel wants to suggest is that the property of systematicity and the compositional syntax and semantics that underlie that property, i.e. having symbols that can be put together according to rules to make complex thoughts, might best be attributed to natural languages themselves, but not to the mental mechanisms involved in language use. So Bechtel's view is that the systematicity is located in the external symbol systems, the language, if you understand language that way, logical formula, whatever it might be. The systematicity is there in the external environment. And what you need internally are just really neat little pattern matching statistical mechanisms so you can latch onto the right external structures. So for Bechtel, the mind isn't systematic. Right? The external structures are systematic. The mind knows how to parasitize those structures in order to produce systematic activity. However, just imagine you thought, as some people have done in the past, that what marks out something as a cognitive system is that it's a physical symbol system. Roughly speaking, a physical symbol system is just a piece of the material world that realizes a system of compositional syntax and semantics. So it's a system that realizes a kind of structure that has symbols and rules for combining those symbols in complex ways. And if you thought that what it is for something to be a cognitive system, it's got to be sufficiently complex, suitably organized, placed in the operating context of complete architecture, so it's got perception mechanisms and so on. But you might think that a physical symbol system, some people have suggested in the past, has the necessary and sufficient means for at least certain aspects of cognition. So you thought that was at least one what you might call a mark of the cognitive. Any system organized like that could do the manipulation of symbols in the kind of way that it looks like we do it in the John Loves Mary case. Any system like that would count as a thinker. And then moreover, to do that kind of thinking, you better be a system of that kind. It's a necessary condition of work. If that's your mark of the cognitive, your theory of the cognitive, you could claim that the Bechtel style network plus the symbol system architecture, the external symbol system, is itself, that whole system, is an instantiation of a physical symbol system. So if you think instantiating a physical symbol system is what it is to be a cognitive system, at least sometimes, then that whole system is the cognitive system, right? That's the extended mind hypothesis. So rather than with Bechtel thinking that the cognitive system is rather simpler than we thought, i.e. it doesn't have all this complex symbolic structure, the complex symbolic structure is outside the mind, all we do here is say, well, what it is to have a mind is to be a system that has all that kind of structure, but as it happens in this case, that system is spread over the brain and the body that can move the symbols around in the world and the symbols that are in the world. So the cognitive system is that extended system. That's the extended mind hypothesis. Now, I give this example because what it seems we have here is a parting of the ways between a kind of extended functionalism that I talked about and a kind of body centrism, right? Because I mean, there's no doubt that we can imagine a physical symbol system instantiated inside the brain. And we can also imagine a physical symbol system that's instantiated as Bechtel's is on my interpretation, through brain, body and environment. So we have the multiple realizability of the cognitive system. Right? So that's the kind of extended functionalism. But the body centrists, of course, are going to push the idea that no, it matters, as it matters that what kind of embodiment you've got here. And thus are not going to be open to the multiple realizability option. So what we've got here is a disagreement over how philosophy and cognitive science should conceive the body. As an implementing substrate, a la extended functionalism and the extended mind, or as a vital and irreplaceable determinant of cognitive life, body centrism. Here's a quote from Jennifer Hornsby. I'm going to give myself another few minutes to finish this off. Here's a quote from Jennifer Hornsby. So just take stock here for a moment. Philosophers of mind have come to see Cartesian dualism as a great enemy, but underestimated what they have to contend with. Taking the putatively immaterial character of mind to create the only problem that there is for Descartes' account, they marry up the picture of the person with the picture of their brain and settle for a view of mind which, though material in its cranial substance, is Cartesian in its essence. Just hang on to that quotation for a moment. So I'm not going to do it probably the next slide. I'm going to show this. Now I'm going to borrow something from Christine. That kind of neo-Cartesian strategy, where you take the basic structure of the Cartesian mind and you just say, yeah, and it happens in the brain, right? And thus you get away with substance dualism. You don't have substance dualism anymore. What you've done, in effect, is to specify what it is to have a mind independently of the embodiment, and then just, as it were, say, and by the way, it's embodied, right? The body becomes a kind of realizing machine for the Cartesian mind. Now, Hornsby accuses philosophers of mind in general of not rethinking the nature of the Cartesian mind when they ditch substance dualism, But leaving the mind as it was pretty intact in terms of how it's structured, you know, representations, rational rules, so on, whatever it may be, and then just seeing the brain as the kind of thing that can realise that kind of system. Indeed, one might think a physical symbol system. Now, as Christian puts it in The Common Woman, this is a case of an immaterial eye that's only lodged in the flesh, of a form imposed on matter by the mind in a top-down way. And that's the kind of strategy one might have for embodying thought. Right, so the subtitle of the talk now becomes important. Right? This is a case of thinking, working out what thought is, and then embodying it, right, to avoid substance dualism. This is a case of embodying thought. Now, though, an extended cognition, the extended mind hypothesis, given its dependence on, now I want to just unpack something here in the Bechtel case. Note that what I did in the Bechtel case was talk about what it was for something to be a mind, to be a physical symbol system hypothesis. And I told you about symbols and being moved around. And the only thing that makes it a physical symbol system hypothesis is that you see those symbols as realised in some bit of the physical world. Right? So I specified what it is for something to have a mind, and then I embodied it. I embodied it one way in the brain, I embodied it another way in the distributed system of brain, body and world that we see in Bechtel's solution. So this is another example. It's an example that turns on implementational materiality, but it follows the same neo-Cartesian logic. But we can specify what the mind is independently of embodiment, and then we just embody it. Indeed, it seems to me that the claim of the extended cognition hypothesis to be an embodied cognition hypothesis is limited simply to the way in which non-neural bodily movements and structures are now part of the realising material substrate of cognition. That's it. Which is why some people, when they've come across extended mind, think it's a kind of disembodied hypothesis. But that's the diagnosis of what. So, the logic of embodiment, one might think, and this is again to Quinn and Christy, the logic of embodiment characterised by this implementational materiality might be ruled out if we rethink things from the position of the female, as Christian puts it. The subject position of the female is more integrally linked with embodiment, more tied to fleshiness, as she puts it, than that of the male. There's a historical diagnosis. But of course, we want cognitive science to be a truly general science of cognition, right? Not just to be a science of some sort of androcentric kind of strategy thinking about cognition. So what we seem to be wanting here is to switch our science of embodied cognition away from thinking of it as a science of embodied thought and think of it instead as a science of thinking bodies. And that's an important difference. Okay, so we accept this kind of rethinking from the position of the female. And we accept it from cognitive science, but we can accept it for good, you know, feminist, philosophical and political reasons. We can also accept it from the perspective of cognitive science, indeed, it seems to me. Again, a truly general science of cognition, one that does justice to the differences of experience and ontology that we see stressed in feminist philosophy. What's this science of thinking bodies going to be like? Well, the first move might be to oscillate onto the other horn of the original embodiment dilemma. Do we go implementational? Do we go body centric? It invites a kind of body centrism. We say, look, we're not going to have implementational materiality. We're going to have vital materiality. As a reaction to the disembodied neo-Cartesian narrative that structures both the extended mind hypothesis and standard thinking in cognitive science, any kind of functionalist hypothesis. Right, so this invites a kind of reaction to body centrism. But I think the logic of embodiment characterised by vital materiality flies in the face of our deep-rooted intuitions about multiple realisability. The idea that we think different embodiments can share the same cognitive states and processes. And moreover, I think, although I'm sure Christine has an easy way out of this, but it seems to me there's a tension within Christine's work here. If we think about the link between the identity of the female and embodiment as integral in a way that's not captured in the case of at least historical way in which male cognition has been developed, or male identity has been developed, rather than the way Christine approaches these things, I think there is a tension of a sort with Christine's claim that we identify thought from the perspective of the female, that will also have a purchase on male identity. It seems that requires a kind of some idea of multiple realisability, which if you go too body-centric, you don't get. Okay? So we have a kind of top-down, bottom-up battle going on. Right? Now, I don't know how to solve this. Right? I don't know how to solve this. What we need is a science of thinking bodies without body-centrism. Right? Now, I did have some other slides on kind of some ways in which dynamical ideas go, but I think probably better to stop and have a discussion now, because there's a kind of another spin in this, which if anyone asks a question that's relevant, I'll just show the slides, because that's the kind of guy I am. But that seems to be a reasonable question to end on. Somehow, they're thinking about embodiment is core, it seems to me, between a kind of functionalist, neo-Cartesian, implementational materiality view, and then on the other hand, a view that drags us towards a kind of body-centrism, that then denies a certain kind of multiple realisability that we want, or at least puts pressure on a kind of multiple realisability that we want, both for cognitive science and, it seems to me, for a good philosophical understanding of human beings to core. Right, so that's where I'll stop. Thanks.